Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's take just a moment and take a look at this preliminary budget document that was leaked to the Washington Post. I think looking at the health care, the federal health programs and the budgets for that is definitely worth looking at a time when we're also looking at cuts to physicians' fees in Medicare and rising costs to run a medical office or run a medical business, and cuts to the federally qualified health care centers, cuts to Medicaid, cuts to the federal support as well. So basically, the budget, that this 64-page document that calls for cuts, but also a major shuffling and reorganization of health and human service agencies. And I can tell you, whenever you have a major reorganization, you're going to end up with quite a bit of disorganization and waste and, of course, front-loaded costs, just even to change the stationery so that the letter goes out on the right department's letterhead is going to be a mess. Sometimes it's better to leave well enough alone, but, of course, that's not a possibility at the moment. But it appears that there are people in the government who don't agree with what's going on in the government. So there's going to be a major, major downsizing to the tune of about $80 billion in discretionary funding. Now, that's not the only downsizing, but the administration has already downsized the Health and Human Services by about 25% of its workforce. That works out to about 20,000 new unemployed people. And they've laid off all of the CDC disease control prevention staff who worked on programs to prevent gun violence, always a hot button topic, if you'll pardon the pun, prevent drowning, improve worker safety, and testing for sexually transmitted diseases and hepatitis. All of those people were laid off. I will remind you that we covered this a few months ago. We're in the middle of a massive uptick in syphilis in the United States, and because we no longer test for syphilis when people get married, we are also seeing we're seeing many more cases of congenital syphilis, which is serious birth defects that do not heal. So you're talking about permanently damaged children for want of screening. Let's cut screening. That is a rational approach. That's going to save money. The discretionary budget for HHS in 2024 was $121 billion. They're going to cut it to $80 billion, and that $40 billion cut is going to a lot of places. Most of what the feds do and most of what HHS does is try to get ahead of healthcare problems. So reducing Medicare and Medicaid programs is going to increase the number of people who can't get ahead or be screened for or treated promptly for common health problems because of lack of access. Now, they're going to create a new $20 billion agency out of the remaining 80, I guess, named the Administration for a Healthy America. And AHA would take care of many of the other agencies that are being consolidated or closed. This one's going to be primary care, environmental health, and AIDS. Specific programs that are being cut are things that are directly contrary to what the new head of HHS, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., wants to do with his Make American Healthy Again initiatives, which includes chronic childhood diseases. So the program that childhood lead poisoning, the program for, and this is one that has me particularly worried, is that they are really gutting the rural health initiatives. And you've heard of food deserts. Well, We've got obstetric deserts where women have to travel hours for a prenatal visit. And guess what happens? If you have several kids and no childcare, you can't do it. So that prenatal visit designed to spot problems early and prevent preterm labor and low birth weight and all of the things that we know are associated with higher infant mortality and poor maternal outcome, all of those things are actually being cut quite substantially. The chronic disease program that works on heart disease, obesity, diabetes, and smoking cessation, those are all being cut. But the rural healthcare problems, cuts are probably going to lead to closing hospitals, and that is never, ever good. The Head Start program, all of the federal funding for that appears to be on the chopping block. And we have to fight back. We have to promise the legislature. We have to promise people that we will take this back and we will need you to get this refunded, because the health of our children is at stake here. And, you know, more dead children is not exactly what we have in mind when we talk about make America healthy again. On a related note, latest data on infant mortality and United States abortion bans. So this is statistics from 2012 through 2023. And they found higher than expected infant mortality in states after the adoption of abortion bans. So we're looking at an increase, a 5% increase, and that's a substantial increase, going from 5.9 per 1,000 live births to 6.3 per 1,000 live births. So abortion bans actually increase infant mortality. And these were in populations that already experience higher than average rates of infant mortality, particularly Black infants compared to other racial and ethnic groups. They went up a full 1.2 deaths per 1,000 live births. That's an increase of 1.15%. Congenital abnormalities was higher, but the rate not due to congenital anomalies, which might have been expected to be eliminated by abortion, even when you control for that, you still see an almost 4% relative increase. And of course, you know, everything's bigger in Texas, including the increase in childhood, in infant mortality rates. So change does come at a cost. This comes from John in Santa Cruz, subject radiation x-rays for Dupuytren's. I was listening to the latest Peter Attia Drive podcast, and they discussed very low radiation for all matter of tendinitis, arthritis, etc., apparently well studied in Germany. And then I was listening to your show, and there was a gentleman with Dupuytren's, which is also treatable via radiation. Seems like a great approach to me. And so John very kindly sent me a link to a publication that came out in 2013. It was in the British Dupuytren's Society. Now, Dupuytren's is, you've probably seen someone who has had it. It's a disease where the tendons of the fingers, the flexor tendons, become scarred to their capsule, and scar tissue, as you know, shrinks. And so for people with this disease, their fingers won't straighten out completely in the early stages. And then over time, their fingers begin to contract and bend until they sort of take a claw-like appearance and are not very useful. I've treated this with a number of different things over the years. There's now some injectable therapies that seem to work quite well. There's also endoscopic surgery and open surgeries. But a lot of people who've had the open surgery are not happy with their cosmetic results, and the endoscopic requires a great deal of practice to do well. So the United Kingdom, the National Institute for Health, has issued limited guidance for radiotherapy on early Dupuytren's disease, that is to say before you get to the level of the claw. And Radiation therapy, as you may know, is a well-established treatment for cancer. It uses ionizing radiation to damage the DNA in cancerous cells. And it's sometimes used for the treatment of benign tumors that cannot be surgically operated on but are impinging on important structures. For superficial lesions, something that's literally just below the skin, like Dupuytren's, the amount of radiation is a lot lower than that that's used for malignant conditions. And so it's thought that that probably reduces the risk of cancer side effects by a great deal. With radiation therapy, the nodules and cords associated with Dupuytren's are irradiated either with X-rays or with electrons. And this is done over 5 days in a row, applying a daily dose of about 3 GY, limited to a few, which has penetration to only a few millimeters. The total dose then is 5 GY. And a GY or a gray, it's the European, it's metric, of course. So one rad, which is what we use here, is 1/100th of a gray. A gray has a nice kind of logical measurement. It's 1 joule per kilogram, and it equals 100 rads. So we're talking, if you're trying to translate that, this is considered a low dose and something that you don't need a lead apron for, although I'm sure they probably use them. After that treatment, a person typically takes a break for 8 to 12 weeks, and then the treatment is repeated. And often the result is reducing the inflammation, getting rid of the scarring cells, and softening the cords or nodules. And it slows down or even completely halts the disease progression. This can be done with both X-rays and electrons because X-rays, while they only go about 3 to 4 millimeters below the skin surface, that's deep enough. Electrons go a lot deeper, but you need a linear accelerator to do those therapies. So just a regular X-ray machine, if it's a sophisticated one, could probably do this therapy. I did not have time to check whether this is available locally, but obviously if a person out there with early Dupuytren's, and I would emphasize, you should have like electric power cords in your hand, but still be able to get the fingers more or less straight. That's early disease. And nipping early disease in the bud is exactly what we all hope to do all the time. So thank you very much to John for bringing that interesting information to our attention. And we're going to roll right into a brief news story of there's a lot of sort of semi-sexual stories today. I wasn't doing that on purpose, but I understand that's good for getting the consumer's attention. So let's go with bacterial vaginosis. Treating it as if it were a sexually transmitted infection might actually lower the recurrence rates. So BV is basically a dysbiosis of the vagina. Ordinarily, the vagina has a nice low pH, and that low pH discourages the growth of yeast and bacteria that don't like a low pH. So we have this wonderful probiotic called lactobacillus, which loves acid and makes acid, and that's its environment, self-creates its own perfect little haven down there in the vagina and kind of keeps everybody out, because what's healthy for lactobacillus is not likely to encourage the growth of these other organisms. But there are some organisms that can get in there and fight the lactobacillus, and one of those is Gardnerella vaginalis, and that's the disease that causes bacterial vaginosis. Typically, the symptoms for that are a strange watery discharge, much more than normal, and smell that is very distressing for the person, because it's sort of a spoiled milk smell, and no one wants to go around smelling like that. So we have to treat it with antibiotics, and the idea is you kill off this bacterial bloom, if you will. And the problem is that about 50% of the women who were treated with the standard week-long course experienced a recurrence within 12 weeks. It has been associated with this disease has been associated in the past with getting it after having a new sexual partner, but researchers decided to test the impact of treating both partners, which is what we would do in a case of, say, gonorrhea or chlamydia. We treat both partners so that they don't play ping pong with the organism. So they randomly assigned 164 adult couples with BV who were in monogamous heterosexual relationships to partner treatment, in which the male received both the antibiotic and a topical antibiotic cream, whereas in the control group, only the women took the oral antibiotic. After 3 months, the difference was clear. Recurrence occurred in 35% of the women whose partners received treatment, and 63%, double almost, of the women whose partners did not. This supports the theory that men may be a reservoir, as we like to say in epidemiology, for disease, and that the bacteria can come back because it lives under the foreskin or in the urethra, and when the couple has sex again, it gets back in there and is able to reestablish itself. Recent research looking at recurrent bladder infections actually has shown that when you treat an infection with antibiotics, that certain bacteria, and Gardnerella is one of them, actually have the ability to go into a dormant state and get into the surface area of the epithelium and just kind of hang out like seeds until the antibiotic goes away. So that's pretty crazy. And I think we have to really just take a deep breath and enjoy our science and change the way we practice medicine in order for us to get somewhere. We're going to take a moment now and go to another listener letter. This one comes from, Peggy. Thyroid or menopause symptoms? Dear Dr. Dong, thank you for your invaluable work. I've been listening since 2006 and recently started tuning in live from Florida. Wow, okay. Peggy in Florida. I'm 61 and had a nipple-sparing bilateral mastectomy for estrogen receptor positive DCIS, which stands for ductal carcinoma in situ. That's there is cancer, but it hasn't escaped into the muscles or into the lymph tissue. That's what DCIS means. So there's no lymph node involvement. And she, of course, went off of her hormone replacement patch, and she started an androgen blocker called an aromatase inhibitor, which basically prevents you from moving through the processing that of cholesterol that creates estrogen, and started that in March 2024. She's taking a fexolinetant, which is a drug for hot flashes, just came out, pretty expensive. It's a neurokinin blocker, so it's a brand new drug category. I want to speak to that just briefly and say that in December, and you started it in March, so in December, the FDA put out a black box warning on that agent, and a black box warning means that we've found something new that didn't show up in the original testing, and it was liver issues happening at a fairly high frequency. So what they're recommending is that when you start this drug, you check liver enzymes every month for 2 or 3 months, and then at 3 month intervals for the first year. And at the end of that year, if everything is copacetic, then you can do annual liver tests just with the physical. But it isn't doing everything that Peggy needs. She goes on to write, I'm struggling with severe mood swings, depression, anxiety, weight gain, and insomnia, particularly waking up at 2 or 3 a.m. and struggling to return to sleep. My gynecologist ruled out hormone replacement therapy, and that's legit because of her estrogen positive status, and referred her to her endocrinologist, suspecting thyroid involvement. I've been hypothyroid since my mid-20s, and my TSH has been suppressed for many years. Here are my recent labs. And she goes on to give the labs, and there's some interesting findings here that I will detail just briefly. But I would put a shout out to the endocrinologist because they ordered a bunch of good stuff. They looked at vitamin D levels. They looked for thyroid peroxidase antibodies, which were very low in this person because her immune system has already destroyed her thyroid, so there's no target left. So the antibody production is very low. And her TSH is, from her supplementation, indeed a little bit suppressed. Not so much that it's going to cause osteoporosis, but right on the borderline of too much, which is really where you want to keep someone, if you can. But her free T3 is in the middle range, and I'll come back to why that's relevant. Also, her iron stores are a little bit lower. Ferritin is only 34. So I wanted to ask Peggy if part of her waking up comes to just feeling antsy, like she wants to move. And so the first thing that we would want to do is add, maybe for your situation, we're going to try to stay out of more drugs if we can. You could add 5-HTP, which is tryptophan, but it's a special kind of tryptophan that increases your levels of serotonin. That would be good. You should fix the ferritin by taking iron. You should stop caffeine, alcohol, and any carbohydrates at night. A lot of people will, you know, have some toast or some crackers to get to sleep. What I'm suggesting instead is, if you're not a vegan, eat protein, maybe some slices of turkey meat, and consider using Lexapro, which is an antidepressant that can help in this situation. But probably what I would say, if sleep waking up is the only issue, is maybe trying a little bit of trazodone, T-R-A-Z-O-D-O-N-E. And that is, when I say a little bit, I'm talking maybe 12.5 to 25 milligrams when you wake up. It's very fast acting. And if you take a little baby dose of it, you'll probably get back to sleep fairly quickly and hopefully sleep through the rest of the night, but not take so much that you'll have a hangover effect. Other questions that Peggy had is, she tells us that she's already taking melatonin, she's already taking magnesium glycinate, she's already taking L-theanine, which is what we find in green tea that's relaxing. So at this point, we're starting to move into pharmaceutical territory because she's gotten most of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to herbs. But I would suggest those behavioral changes if you haven't already started with that. It's interesting about those neurokinin 3 receptors. I'm getting a little science-y on you right now. They were initially developed in the 80s to treat schizophrenia, but they didn't work very well. But they had this side effect of helping with vasomotor instability, which is what happens in menopause when women get hot flashes. And what's going on is that as estrogen levels drop, the hypothalamic thermostat, it's called the thermoneutral zone, which is supposed to keep your body at 97.9 or whatever, you know, the average body temperature really is. And so due to the declining levels of estrogen, this thing becomes super sensitive. And over study, we've learned that this neurokinin 3 receptor, and that a whole bunch of chemicals are released trying to control body temperature, and they actually overshoot. And what they found in postmortem studies of postmenopausal women who had, they found hypertrophy of these neurons. So essentially, estrogen was keeping them suppressed. Take away the estrogen, it's like taking the lid off a boiling pot, and the heat just boils over. And so by blocking these neurokinin receptors, it was, it's like, oh, wait, we threw this on the shelf. Maybe we'll find a use for it later. It's a little bit like drug hoarding, you know, back there in the lab. But yeah, it works quite well. The studies are very beneficial. If it wasn't for the liver effects, I'd probably be first at the table on this one, because this in breast cancer patients can be a very difficult issue. So just fair warning, you might be able to keep the dose low or even come off of this after a few years. We don't know that. So the main thing I want to tell you is I hope that some combination of what I've just suggested helps you get where you want to get. And thank you, Peggy, so much for your email. We'll do one more quick story. Children grow up. And one of the things that we are learning is that as little trans women grow up, they don't generally lose their prostate. And we have no idea how to monitor them when they get into their 40s and 50s. And normally what we're doing now, and the rate of doing this is actually the age of recommendation has been floating around, but the latest recommendation was to bring it down to 45 for Caucasians, males who are cis males, and look for a level of 4. And this study is saying, okay, well, trans females are taking estrogen in order to be an effective trans female, and that really drops their PSA to almost indetectable, which means we don't, and it happens even in people who have cancer. Their PSAs are very low. So we've essentially lost our screening tool for individuals as they get into their 40s. And they looked at 14,000 trans women and found that the average PSA level was about 0.2. That's a tenth of what it would be if they weren't taking the estrogen. So we don't know what we need to be doing. I'm thinking cheap MRI is probably where we'll need to go. By the way, cheap MRI could happen very readily if the state would just buy some MRI centers and fund them, and then we could do MRIs on all the women with dense breasts.
Yes, I was going to say that that's something that is really needed. Is insurance won't pay for MRIs for women who have dense breast tissue.
Right.
And it's like the best way.
Well, they'll pay for the cancer therapy.
They will.
Woohoo.
As a doctor recently said to me, knowing that I know a lot about this, she said, you know, we are in the curing disease business, not in the making people healthy, stay healthy business, you know, preventing disease business. And it's unfortunate that that's how our healthcare system is.
You know, that may be one of the few things I agree with RFK on is is that we really should be paying more attention to prevention and improving the health of our food supply, the availability of re-engineering of our public space so that it's more exercise friendly, all of these things that they have. You go to Europe, it's like it's impossible to be in a European city and not get 10,000 steps just from point A to point B.
And I think most Americans have no idea how much less healthy we are as a nation, as a population. Even when you look, when you take out the least healthiest of us, you would think that we, with all the money we have and the fancy medicine we have, but we're not as healthy as we should be.
Well, thank you, Suki, for those astute comments. Suki is helping me today with this pledge show, which we won't bother you with here. But to all you podcast listeners, please go to ksqd.org to support this station, or go to your own local community's station's website to show your support for your own independent community radio station or your local NPR radio station. Thank you. Okay, we're going to go to read one more letter, and then we'll see where it takes us. This one from Cheryl in Eugene, Oregon. Cheryl writes, dizziness, not spinning, but terrible balance stability when standing or walking every time, but not with sitting or lying down. With the information I've listed below, please suggest what kind of specialist referrals we should try to get. And she's actually writing about a man in her world, a 61-year-old male, 5'11", 210 pounds, blood pressure on the higher end of normal, resting heart rate 99. That flags for me. That's a bit high. His latest lipids result from October 23 were triglycerides of 203. That also flags for me. That's an indicator of maybe some insulin resistance. HDL of 47, which is not bad for a 61-year-old male. LDL of 136, total cholesterol 224. He was a heavy beer drinker for 14 years, but quit 2 years ago. That also flags for me, and I'll get to that in a minute. He drinks 32 ounces of water a day, plus a full 12-cup pot of coffee, which is three parts decaf and one part caffeinated, and about three 12-ounce Keurig decafs. So even though he's drinking 32 ounces of water, he's drinking an awful lot. Let's see, 12 times 8. You know, he's actually drinking more diuretic fluid than he's drinking actual free water. So that could certainly account for the for some of the stability when he stands up, because he may have hypovolemia, as we say in medicine, which means his absolute blood volume is on the low side. 2 days ago, he's increasing his water intake from 40 to 60, but we need to get him off some of that diuretic, because even decaf coffee is still a diuretic, and that's something many people don't realize. There's a lot of things that pull water that come along in that cup of coffee besides the caffeine. He's had acid reflux that used to set off terribly in the last year of his heavy drinking. Certain foods cause him acid reflux, and he limits his generic Prilosec to one pill per week. But I'm guessing that when he was having the terrible acid reflux, he was using a lot more. He's had 5 COVID vaccines. People always say that. He does snore. They're going to see a sleep referral, but there is a shortage in their area in Eugene, Oregon. So it's been over a year since the referral was made, and he's still not gotten the call for his sleep studies. And they have a very, very long waiting list. So I'm going to digress for a moment on this one, Cheryl, and tell you about the SNAP company, S-N-A-P. It's a mail order sleep test that you can get. I think the out-of-pocket is about $100. It does have to be ordered by a doctor in California. It could be that you can self-order it in Oregon, and I can pretty much guarantee that you can order it in Florida, because Florida is the Wild West when it comes to patient-controlled labs and testing. You can probably find a company in Florida that will ship you the little kit that you need, and you just ship it back. But this is a simple test. You put something on the finger to monitor oxygen. You put an elastic strain gauge around the chest. And if the chest stops moving and the oxygen drops below 90, and it does that a lot, you've got sleep apnea. So that would be a real factor here in his long-term health, but probably not why he's having the dizziness. Now, I'm suspecting vitamin B12 deficiency. He has a lot of risk factors for that, the chief ones being heavy drinking and the Prilosec, which prevents you from absorbing B12. If you've got a tuning, the tests that he needs to do, and his primary care doctor may have done these. One is a Romberg test, where you have him stand up with his eyes closed and just nudge him a little bit and see if he loses his balance and has to take a step and open his eyes. The other one's called the tuning fork test, and you just strike a tuning fork and then see if he can feel the vibration on his toes. If he can't feel the vibration, then he's going to have trouble balancing, and his nerves that go to the veins in his legs, which wrap around, the veins have muscles wrapping around them like donuts, and when the nerves say contract, those muscles contract. If a person's deficient in B12, that process does not work well. So when he's lying down or sitting, he's fine. When he stands up, all the blood rushes to his feet. It's now going down, you know, almost 6 feet. Rather, the heart's, you know, having to pump its, you know, up a 6 feet hill rather than having to pump it up a 3 foot hill. Makes a big difference. The doctor can check orthostatic blood pressure, where you do the blood pressure lying down and then sitting and then standing, and see what happens. If the if the heart rate goes up more than 20 points to maintain the blood pressure, then that's a positive. And his blood pressure's, his resting heart rate's 99, which is another clue that he might try this. Now, we have a second question, and we have just enough time. He also gets an incredible buildup of wax in his ears, which has hardened so much that when the nurse last year tried to clean the wax out of the ears, she caused him pain. They recommended we try Dubrox, but it caused him more discomfort, so we haven't done anything in about a year. Now, he could have just a big wad of wax pushing against the eardrum. That'll affect his hearing, but it could also contribute to dizziness, although probably it would still be there with lying down or sitting. Any kind of position change would probably trigger it. By the way, a good trick for earwax is just put a little hydrogen peroxide, just the regular brown bottle that you buy at the supermarket or drugstore, two or three drops in the ear, left side, left ear on even numbered nights and right ear on odd numbered nights, and your pillows will start showing little yellow stains from the melted earwax. And if you keep at it long enough, you'll get through all of the earwax plug. And so just want to thank you, Cheryl, for offering these problems. I know that there's always someone listening who goes, hey, I better ask for that tuning fork test. I've got that. And that's what makes this program go around. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.